is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist, Jefferson Mason, and marketing manager, Nick Bartlett, on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training with over 150 plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com. Follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And make sure you mention the Hoopheads podcast to get $300 off your next Dr. Dish purchase. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get out and get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
When you take away decisions, when you take away defenders, when you take away directions, practice looks good today. But every bit of research in education, every bit of research in sport, and there is a lot of it, says that that is... It's a false indicator that short-term performance is a poor indicator of long-term learning.
John O'Sullivan is the author of the book, Every Moment Matters, How the World's Best Coaches Inspire Their Athletes and Build Championship Teams. John's book is without question one of the most influential books I have ever read on coaching. It doesn't matter what age or skill level you're coaching, or even what sport. You can take the ideas and concepts John presents in this book and become a better coach that makes a bigger impact on your team and your athletes, both on and off the court. John O'Sullivan started the Changing the Game Project in 2012 after 2 decades as a soccer player and coach on the youth, high school, college, and professional level. He is the author of numerous best-selling books besides Every Moment Matters, including Changing the Game, The Parent's Guide to Raising Happy, High-Performing Athletes, Giving Youth Sports Back to Our Kids, and Is It Wise to Specialize? John's work has been featured in The Huffington Post, on CNN.com, in Outside Magazine, on ESPN.com, Soccer America, and numerous other publications. He is an internationally known speaker for coaches, parents, and youth sports organizations, and he has spoken for TEDx, the National Soccer Coaches Association of America, U.S. Lacrosse, IMG Academy, and at numerous other events throughout the United States, Canada, Asia, and Europe. John brings a wealth of practical hands-on knowledge garnered through years of working with players and their families on sports-specific development, fitness and nutrition, college recruiting, and most importantly, training high-performing athletes by creating a player-centered environment. As the Hoopheads podcast audience grows week by week, your 5-star ratings and review help fuel our growth. Please subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app. When you do, the latest episodes will hit your phone as soon as they drop. Let a friend or coaching colleague know about the show and join the thousands of others who have become a part of Hoopheads Nation. If you're a coach at any level, in any sport, or the parent of an athlete, you'll find tremendous value in this episode as we talk with John O'Sullivan, the author of Every Moment Matters. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome back to the podcast from the Changing the Game Project and the author of the brand new book, Every Moment Matters, John O'Sullivan. John, welcome back.
Guys, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
We are
having me on again.
Having you on again, a dual appearance here. So yeah. That's exciting. It's always nice to have somebody who's been on that wants to come back on. We take that as a ringing endorsement, John. So
yeah, perfect.
All right. So we want to talk about the book. And as I told you before we jumped on, I just think the book is outstanding. It's one of the best books that I've read on coaching on a number of levels. And the first level just is, it's a great refresher for coaches about the why behind the reasons why we coach. And then number two, I think there's a ton of actionable information that you could read a section and immediately pull something out. And later that day in your practice, you can put that into use. So I think you've done a tremendous job. And I want to start out by, let's just touch on the title. Every Moment Matters. How'd you come up with the title? What does the title mean? Share your thoughts behind why you decided to call the book Every Moment Matters.
This is a great question. So, you know, a lot of people, when you're writing a book, they say, oh, what's it called? I'm like, you know, the title is like the last thing you come up with. It's not the first thing you come up with, unless you're writing, you know, Harry Potter 2, right? So it's like, you know, so this was this thing is I knew what I wanted to say. And as the book evolved, you know, anyone listens to our podcast, Way of the Champions, I always sign off saying, you know, your influence is never neutral. You know, so go out there and make a difference. You're always going to make a positive or a negative impact. So be intentional about what you do. And, you know, something like your influence is never neutral didn't seem like a great title, but it was that idea really resonated with me. And then, you know, as I'm putting the book together and talking about stuff. I was down in Colorado Springs at the Olympic Training Center, and I got to spend some time with a guy named Terry Steiner, who's the women's national team wrestling coach. And he told the story of wrestling, you know, that was very influential for him. He was doing a wrestling session, and this trainer said to him, you know, what's the difference between an artist and a coach? And he's like, I don't know. He says, you know, at the end of the day, an artist can throw his work away and start again, but a coach never can. And just how, and he's like, you know, so you just have to be intentional. And what he said, what Terry said is, you know, every day has got to be a gold medal day, because you don't know if this is the day when a kid is going to be ready to learn, when there's going to be this moment that they're going to remember for the rest of their life. So you have to be on. And so all this stuff milling around in my head, I was sitting around with my brother. My parents both had some health issues this fall. I was back in New York, hanging out with them, hanging out, talking about my book, talking about all the family stuff and things we've done. And I explained this to my brother, and he says, so what you're saying is every moment matters. And I was like, yeah, I think that's the title, Des. Thanks so much. You know,
ding, ding, ding.
So there we go. So I'll take credit for the subtitle, but I got to give my brother Desmond full kudos for the main title.
Well, it's a really good title, and I think it captures the book perfectly, and it captures, I think, what it means to be a coach. And I one of the things that I've said as we've gone through the podcast and talked to various people and talked about coaching, and I think it's a thread that kind of comes through the book, and I think it's something that I pulled out of what you said as just an overall thought process here, is that coaching is all about being intentional. And when you're intentional, then you can do and say things that are going to have an impact, as you said, in a positive way and not in a negative or neutral way. And I think that when you talk about intentionality, you talk about a coach who's putting in the time to prep and is demonstrating that they care about their athletes. And to me, that's really a great place for us to start. And I want to talk first about one of the things that you mentioned right off the top of the book, which is the top five things that kids say they want in a coach. And I'm going to just kind of go through each one at a time and give you a chance to talk about what each of these five means to you. And let's start with kids say that
and all I'll say is those ones are at the tip of my tongue because I've been teaching that stuff for years, you know.
All right, well, good. Yeah, I'll read them anyway, so you don't have to quiz them, because I have my notes in front of me. So
read them out. But
all
yeah,
right, so first one, respect and encouragement.
Respect and encouragement. I mean, which person, regardless of whether you're a child in sport or an adult in sport or an adult on a sales team, doesn't want respect and encouragement, right? What's the opposite? Disrespect me and discourage me? Yeah, right.
That's not gonna give me more of that, please, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Number two, a positive role model. This one I think about all the time for myself as a coach, because I know that as a parent and as a coach, that my kids or my players are always, and my parents are always looking to me to sort of set the standard of what's expected, how we do things. So talk a little bit about why, to you, it's so important for a coach to be a role model.
Yeah, and I'll give the shout out first that these five phrases come from Amanda Visick from George Washington, her research, you know, into this. So this isn't something that, you know, I made up in the book or anything. But yeah, positive role model. I mean, you know, especially in youth sport and school sports, this is sport for development, right? And you know, there used to be this really strong connection between, you know, school sport was the extension of what you did during school. Same values, same ideas. Probably your English teacher was also your basketball coach, right? And in the last couple of decades, there's been sort of this divide, and oftentimes at 3 o'clock, right, the person now coaching you is the antithesis of everything you value all day. But I think teachers and I think coaches in sport for development, we are supposed to be role models. We are teaching kids to have a teachable spirit, to admit vulnerability, to compete, to work hard, to be prepared, to be committed, all these sort of things. And again, what's the opposite? You know, a negative role model? Like, why would a kid ever want that? You know, I think we've all had that coach. And when we get together with our friends 20 years later, we laugh about that coach.
So true. So true. Number three, clear, consistent communication.
Yeah, you know, I'll put two together because there's two on communication, that list, clear communication and be a good listener, right? So, you know, communication is two-way. Number one, coach to athlete, right? Be clear in your expectations. Be consistent in those expectations. You know, be fair. Don't treat one player one way and one the other. Learn to teach effectively, right? So learn to, you know, do things and speak in a way that, you know, it's not just you teaching, it's them actually learning. And then be a good listener. So take input from your athletes as well. Let them have a voice. Let them have ownership. Let them say something. I mean, at the top level of sport now, professional athletes have a bigger and bigger voice all the time. And the more, like take a sport like basketball, it's a super dynamic game. Right, we want players to be able to solve problems on the fly, to make decisions when the play breaks down. Well, how can they do that if we don't give them a voice into what's happening out there? And so, you know, when they speak up, we also have to listen. We can't just be the sage on the stage all the time.
Yeah, I think that it's good that the coaching profession is definitely shifting in that direction. And you think back to the time maybe when you and I first were playing as young players, and I think it was much more common to have that coach who the my way or the highway coach. And not that those coaches don't still exist, because unfortunately there still are some coaches that are out there coaching that way. But I think you're much more seeing people who are doing the things that you just described in terms of communication, in terms of valuing input from the players. And you have a line in the book that the knowledge needs to be out on the field and not on the sideline. And I just thought that was a line that really sort of encapsulates that, you know, when you have the coach standing on the sideline trying to orchestrate every player, or worse, you have the player's parent in the stands trying to orchestrate everything.
Or worse, they're both doing it and saying the opposite things.
For sure. No question about that. We've all been there and seen that. If you've had any dealings with the youth sports environment, you've no doubt been exposed to both parents and coaches that have exposed their players and kids to that particular experience. But I think, as you said, especially when you're playing a dynamic sport, whether it's basketball or soccer or lacrosse or anything that involves decision making, you want the kids to be able to make split second decisions for themselves. And when all they've been taught or all they've been programmed to do is to follow a coach's instruction or a parent's instruction, there's just no way that they can process the instruction from the coach or the parent, or as you said, both, and then make an instantaneous decision that's going to be a good one. And so by listening and hearing what athletes are saying and helping them to work through that by being a good communicator, I think you're ultimately going to produce better athletes that are going to be able to make those decisions and be more confident playing in a dynamic environment like most sports are.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, there's a part of the book I talk about, you know, when we think about, right, if you're coaching high level well, I don't know if there's necessarily high-level 12-year-olds, but if you're coaching 12-year-olds, right, you're preparing them for the future of the game. If they're really going to be elite-level players, you're preparing them for what the game's going to look like 10 years from now. And we don't really know what that is. But what we do know is that there's certain behaviors that transcend changes in the game that have always been qualities that we like. And so, you know, back in, 2010, 2011, England rugby went on this sort of journey of, well, what are these qualities that transcend? And they came up with what they call the CARDS approach. And CARDS is creativity, awareness, resilience, decision-making, self-organization. And they said, you know what? That has to be a part of every practice at every age, because no matter how the game changes or what rules get tweaked or whatever, right? I mean, you look at basketball that's gone from a post game or a pick and roll game to a 3-point open game, right? And stuff. No matter how the game changes, we're going to want players who are creative. We want decision makers. We want self-organizers. We want resilience. And we want people who are thoughtful and mindful and things like that. And so I love this idea of you can't have those qualities in an environment where communication is only one way. It has to be two way because you have to be asking questions. You have to be, you know, checking for understanding. You have to be drawing out of your kids, do you really understand this? What do you see out there? Why did you play that pass? Did you see another option? Why did you shoot there? Right? And this instills these behaviors that transcend any changes in the game.
All right. So that goes, I want to get to more of that with the cards for sure. But yeah. I want to jump back. So we've hit on number five, which goes along with this, which is the knowledge of the sport. So if I'm going to ask those intelligent questions that you just talked about, if I'm going to encourage my players to be creative, if I'm going to teach them how to make good decisions, I have to have, there's a baseline knowledge of the sport that is a non-negotiable. I have to know enough to be able to share my knowledge with my players as a coach. So to go along with what you just said with the cards, one of the things that I think makes it challenging to incorporate all those things, especially if I'm an inexperienced coach or I'm a volunteer coach, is that having all those things incorporated into your practice is messy and it is difficult. Not difficult is the wrong way to say it, but it's sometimes as a coach, it can be, if you're an inexperienced coach who hasn't coached in this particular way before, it's much easier to organize kids into three lines, set up some cones, have them go one-on-one and work on a skill sort of in isolation. Mm-hmm. A, it's easier to keep the kids organized. B, it looks more organized. So when parents are sitting on the sideline watching me coach, they're like, oh, this guy knows what he's doing because he's got them organized in lines and they're, you know, they're working on this skill and look at how he's teaching that. Versus if I'm going to teach creativity, I have to give my players a lot of freedom and I have to design a practice plan that's going to incorporate decision making, that's going to incorporate situations where they're going to have to be able to be resilient and bounce back. Or maybe I just say, okay, we're going to work on this particular skill. You go ahead and organize a drill that's going to help us to work on that. And that's the self-organization piece. And that doesn't always look like learning is taking place. And I think that was a theme that you kind of kept coming back to in the book, is that you have to take the long view instead of the short view. And in the short view, that 1-hour practice where we have lots of lines and lots of cones and we're working on skills in isolation, that may look like learning has taken place and the players may be able to execute a crossover dribble better after they do it 75 times in a row. But when it comes time to a game, are they going to be able to know when and how to execute when there's actually other players out on the court or out on the field? And so talk a little bit about that messy learning type situation and how the long view is more important than the short view.
Mm-hmm. And it's a huge topic. I mean, I spend, you know, part two of the book is, again, like how do I coach? And it has a lot on that, right? So if we're going to think about how do we design practices and what they look like, well, we better understand how people learn. And, you know, there's a lot of, you turn, you know, go to Facebook and there's, you know, 20 knowledge hacks, right? Learn Spanish in 3 days, you know, all this sort of stuff. But, you know, they're all that really what they are hacks. They're not real. What is proven by research is that there's a couple of things. Interleaving is one. So it's repetition without repetition. We're mixing and matching the things that we do in practice. We're not hitting, 57 irons in a row, and we're not just shooting 15, 20 free throws in a row, right? Because that's not representative of what we do in a game. And so we need to interleave our practices. We work on one thing and we work on another component. Now, the opposite of that is what we call massing our practice or blocked practice, where we just focus and we carve it up probably in the wrong place. And, you know, use the examples of lines and cones. Well, what's the difference between a cone and a basketball defender? I've never seen a cone with a 6-7 foot wingspan, you know, sticking his hands in your face and reaching up, right? So dribbling around a cone is totally unrealistic. I mean, I think about, like, you're talking about that. I'm thinking, you know, it'd be much more realistic for kids to dribble through, like, you know, the car wash with the big car dryers, like spinning around and trying to get around those things, because that's what it looks like, you know, trying to dribble through the key. So it's like, sure. You know, when you take away decisions, when you take away defenders, when you take away directions, practice looks good today, but every bit of research in education, every bit of research in sport, and there is a lot of it, says that is it's a false indicator that, you know, short-term performance is a poor indicator of long-term learning. And so the point of teaching something in practice is not so that we'll know it and do it well today. It's so that we can retrieve it later on in a game. A week from now, a month from now, a year from now, that's learning. And so when we start thinking of learning as not my ability to replicate, you know, or show understanding in the short term, but the ability to retrieve it in the long term, well, now we got to follow scientific principles. And that says defenders, direction, decisions, all these sort of things. And so this is not to say that there's never, ever a time to pull a kid out and, you know, tweak a technique because they're shooting and their elbows in the wrong place or their footwork is bad. But if you are spending half your practice, three quarters of your practice working on plays, working on movements without defenders and decisions and directions, you're shortchanging your kids. And I've never met a coach who's like, hey, I have too much practice time. I'd love to give some back. So if that's not the case, then you have to be as effective as possible in the time that you have. And every single bit of research in sport says that means interleaving your practice, spacing out the learning, you know, challenging them with, you know, a game that you did 2 weeks before, but instead of queuing them up with all the things you're looking for, roll out the ball and let them play and see what they do. And if they do the things that you've been working on, guess what? It means they learned it. And if they don't, time to go back and teach it again.
Yeah, I think that, again, by doing that, what's happening is that you use the term in the book, the dial of representativeness, which represents how much does this drill or this activity replicate the game. 10 being it's exactly like the game, 1 being it's not very much like the game at all. And one of the things that I liked that you recommended for coaches to do is to go through and look at your practice plan and look at each drill, look at each activity that you have planned and figure out how representative is this of the game that we're actually going to play when the lights are on. Mm-hmm. And I know for me as a coach that one of the things that I've certainly changed over the last 5 years or so as I've become more aware of what good coaching is changing to make it where there's almost nothing that I'll do now in a practice. And even with, like, right now I'm coaching my youngest daughter who's in fourth grade and I coach her travel basketball team. And there's almost nothing that we do anymore where there's not an offense and a defense. And just as an example, you might do a passing drill where before we might have worked on passing the ball back and forth down the floor. And then at the end, somebody shoots a layup. Well, why can't we just put a defender at the end of the drill? And then at the end, they've got to try to score. Mm-hmm. And it makes it much more game-like. And there's just so many opportunities where, you know, you look at, you know, the way things might have been done in the past. And now just by adding an extra defender or just by putting players in a position where it's much more game-like, you end up getting better results. But to your point, it doesn't always look that way in the moment. The practice in the moment looks messier. It looks like, ooh, it's not quite as organized because kids are trying new things. And when you're trying new things and when you're trying to expand, I think the term used in the book is desirable difficulties, mm-hmm. where you're pushing those kids to the edge of their comfort zone. And yeah, maybe they're not used to coming off the pick and making the read and trying to make the right pass. Or maybe they aren't sure how they got to execute a two-on-one. And how do I know when I'm supposed to pass and when I'm supposed to shoot? But by continuously giving them the opportunity to make those decisions, what you're doing is you're allowing them to hone your decision-making skills. And then also, I think coaching with questions as opposed to coaching with statements is something that's really important. So can you talk a little bit about how important it is to ask questions while you're coaching?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, I'll give you, you know, kudos. You just hit on so many important points. And, you know, this idea of representativeness comes from, I had a guest on the podcast called Ian Renshaw, and he and a couple other guys wrote this great book called The Constraints-Led Approach to Coaching. And that's where that idea comes from, is that, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, right, 1 being, you know, I pass the ball to you, I run to the other end of the line, you pass it to there, right? Not representative. 10 being, right, NBA finals, game 7, tie game, 3 seconds left. That's the most representative. Everything else falls on this spectrum. Now, you can't always practice at 10 out of 10. That's impossible. But what we encourage people to do is look at your drill and say, if on a scale of 1 to 10, how representative is this activity of the game? And if it's a 2, I don't have to make it a 10, but how can I make a 2 a 4, right? Right? You know, I could play, you know, 5 against 3, right? Working on how do we attack a zone. And when that becomes too easy, well, let's play 5 against 4 now before we play 5 against 5, which is very high on the dial. So these things are all important. And then within that, right, instead of always being, you know, stop, give them the solution, play again. Again, the athlete-centered coach stops it and says, what did you see there? Why did you play that pass and not that pass? Did you see any other options? Do you think that was your best option in that situation? If you had to do it again, what would you do? And, you know, sometimes it's great. I like to do that when I think they get it right. You know, like right, they just right. nailed it. And I want them, because the kids are used to, wow, a coach stopped it. And so I must have done something wrong. And so all of a sudden they start backtracking. And I'm like, no. Like, I thought that was perfect. I just wanted to, you know, I just want you to know, like, you know what, coach? I nailed that. Like, I wouldn't do anything different, right? We just scored. Right. Why would I do anything different, right? So using these stoppages, instead of just to know that's the pass, say, what other pass could you have played there? And these are things that, again, makes players think. And if they're thinking the whole time, if they're tuned in, if they're present, it's going to be a more effective practice.
I love the idea of using questions. And it's something that, for me personally, has definitely evolved in my coaching, where if you went back 5-6 years ago, I probably never used questions. It was still always, okay, stop the drill. Here's what I saw as the coach. Here's what I think you should have done, as opposed to asking the player, well, what did you see? Why did you make that decision? And maybe I can still share my thought on what I saw and then compare it to what the player saw. And then we can talk mm-hmm. about it and figure out what's another alternative, as you said. And so that's something that I think all coaches need to keep in mind, is that, you know, you go through and you read a book like yours, and as I told you before, there's just so many great ideas and things and that you can try. And if you're intentional about them and you start adding piece by piece to the things that you already do well, that's what's going to allow you to become an even better coach and be able to allow you to have an even greater impact on your players, both as athletes and the decisions that they're making within the game, and also mm-hmm. have, you know, a bigger impact, which we'll talk about as we move, you know, further on in the book. Head Start Basketball, along with members of the J. Billis Skills Camp staff, will be hosting the very first Prime Skills Camp, an affiliate of the J. Billis Skills Camp that is held annually in Charlotte, North Carolina. Prime Skills Camp will take place on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, June 26th through the 28th, and will be designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9. Prime Skills Camp will mirror the J. Billis Skills Camp in daily programming, teaching, coach-to-camper ratio, and quality of instruction. Prime Skills Camp brings all of the team-oriented individual instruction, focus on the fundamentals, and high-level coaching to young men aspiring to a high school varsity basketball experience. This camp is operated by Billis Camp veterans and includes the J. Billis Coaches Development Program alongside the camp, ensuring that the quality of teaching and coaching at this camp is second to none. Please visit headstartbasketball.com or jbillescamp.com for more information or to get registered. Let's jump back from the how, and let's go back to the why, and give us the story of Steve Kerr and Pete Carroll and how Steve Kerr came up with the things that ended up being the values that he built the Warriors dynasty on.
This is one of my favorite stories. We had the pleasure of having Steve on our podcast because my co-host Jerry and him have worked together for a number of years. And when Steve played for the Bulls, Jerry wrote a book called Thinking Body, Dancing Mind that was mandatory reading for the Bulls. So they've been acquaintances for a couple decades now. So Steve, you know, tells his story when he got the Warriors job, right? First big coach, head coaching job. He was going around trying to meet coaches, and then a friend of a friend set him up with Pete Carroll. And so the Seahawks just won the Super Bowl, and they invited him in for preseason, and he went up there and spent a couple days and stood in the huddle and was just a part. They let him be a part of everything and listen to everything, and he just loved it. He loved the music, the atmosphere, the competitiveness. He's like, this is what I want, you know, the Warriors to feel like. And so after 2 days, Pete Carroll calls him into his office and he says, all right, Steve, so how are you going to coach your team? And Steve was like, well, what do you mean? Be like, what offense are we going to play? What defense? And Pete's like, no. Like, you've played forever. You're going to figure that out. He said, what is it going to feel like when, you know, your players come to work? What's it going to feel like every single day? And Steve's like, I never really thought about it. And Pete Carroll's like, that is the most important thing. You have to know authentically what it's supposed to feel like to be a part of your team. Because if it doesn't feel that way, you're never going to be satisfied. You're not going to be happy. Your players aren't going to be happy because everything's misaligned. And he said, you know, now go home, now go to your hotel tonight and come up with, you know, the 10 things that matter most to you. And then, you know, scrap the bottom six and come up with four. He said, don't use mine, right? Because right. You can't be Pete Carroll. Don't be John Wooden. Be Steve Kerr. What matters to you? Because if you try to be someone else, people will see through it. And so he goes home that night and he comes back the next day and he's got four. And the four, which I love, are, you know, the number one core value is joy. Joy. He's like, you know, we play basketball for a living. Like, this is supposed to be fun. And the other three are mindfulness, right? Because, you know, this was a big thing from his Bulls days, and meditation and awareness and thinking. Competitiveness, obviously we're a professional basketball team. And then compassion. Like, we have to, you know, feel for each other and know everyone's story. And we have to be a big family here. And Steve's a very compassionate guy, and, you know, so was Steph Curry and these other guys in the team. So, you know, he brings those things back, and you basically, Steve said, Pete Carroll said to him, all right, like, your players have to know this without you ever explaining it. Like, they should just feel it every day. And so the Warriors practices are full of music and full of joy and full of, you know, and it's a great family and very mindful and super competitive. And obviously five finals in a row. And, you know, this year, when you lose sort of the player, I mean, take the three best players off any NBA team and you're going to have the worst record in the league. But you know what? They're working hard. They're close. They're building towards next year when they get these guys back. And I think those values, even when they're losing, still come through. So Steve Kerr have a lot of talent? Sure. But he feels very good about who the Warriors are and how they go about things, and so do the players. And when they, you know, when they lost in his second year in the final and Kevin Durant was a free agent, you know, Kevin Durant talked about why to go to the Warriors. He's like, no other team felt like such a family. Like, I wanted to be part. I wanted to feel what they were feeling. And, I just think that's really important that as coaches, that's where we start. What's it supposed to feel like to be here? And if you get that right, everything else follows.
Yeah, I pull out a couple things from there. One is it has to be authentic. So it has to be what you as a coach value. Because if I try to steal Pete Carroll's values, or I try to steal Steve Kerr's values, or I try to steal John Wooden's values, it may not be what I have in my heart and in my mind every single day. So I've got to really sit down as a coach and figure out what those are for me. And for any coach out there, that's a tremendous exercise to take yourself through, is figure out what are those values that I want to base everything that I do is based around those values. And as you said, to be able to incorporate those into your day-to-day practice schedule, where every day you're making sure that those elements are included so that your players feel it. And I think with the Warriors, it would be interesting, and obviously I'm not privy to being in their practices, both during the 5 years when they were in the dynasty and now this year when they've fallen on much harder times. But I would guess that the feeling in the building, although winning certainly feels better than losing, I would guess that the overall feel for what's going on with that team is the same, because the values haven't changed. Although the people have changed, the values haven't. And I think that I would guess that the feeling in the building last year versus this year, in terms of those four values that you listed that Steve Kerr came up with, I'm sure those values still feel the same, regardless of what the scoreboard outcome says.
Well, you know, when he was on our podcast, he said, this was before the season, his biggest challenge was going to be, of the roster of 14, they were going to have, like, I think 9 or 10 new people, right? They'd Kevin Durant left, Klay Thompson injured, out for the year. They lost so many people, and we talked about, well, how do you instill this in so many new people at once? And it's a challenge. And then you lose Steph Curry on top of that, and then you lose they had a couple other injuries, Russell got hurt and some other things, so it's like, man, I mean, every obstacle has been thrown in their way, and yet they're still out there, and they're fighting hard, and they're competing. And it'll be interesting. I'd love to talk to Steve after this season.
Right, for
because
sure.
Because he's a winner. He's a competitor. It's not easy to sit there and lose night after night. It's hard. But I don't think any rational person can all of a sudden say, oh, you know what? Steve Kerr's a bad coach now because they're, 4-15 instead of 15-4.
Right. I
mean, look at the reality. At some point, ability, talent matters.
I know you told that story in the book about asking coaches, well, are you a good coach? And then coaches saying, well, depending on, we won 20 games last year. Yeah, I have 4 athletes that won gold medals. Well, what happens the next year if you're 0-20? Are you still a good coach, or are you a bad coach?
Right.
The reality is that whether you're a good coach or you're a bad coach, you would think that that would remain consistent because of these other things, because of those values, because of the way you go about coaching, both from a value standpoint and from a actual design of your practice standpoint. That's going to be consistent throughout, regardless of what the talent level, whether Steve Kerr has 5 all-stars on his team or whether he has a bunch of undrafted rookie free agents. What he's doing day to day as a coach isn't any different. Now the scoreboard results may be different, but as you said, that's a matter of talent. It's not a matter of what he's doing as a coach. And one of the other things that you talked about here in relation to coming up with your values is you recommended that all coaches come up with a coaching purpose statement. And I know in the book you shared yours. So if you wouldn't mind sharing yours, just so coaches out there who are listening can get an idea of what one sounds like, and then talk a little bit about why you feel that's so important for any coach to put down on paper for themselves.
Well, you know, and so this is, I don't know if I gave it a proper shout out before, but I think one of the most important books that any coach could read is Inside Out Coaching by Joe Ehrman. I, for many years since I first met Joe and since I first read that book, you know, I put that up on my, every time I do a talk, right? It's like, read this book. Like, if you're a coach, you consider yourself a professional coach, you should read this book. And so this is something that he talks about in Inside Out Coaching. You know, what's your why? What's your purpose statement? Because that becomes your foundation, right? That becomes everything that you do, everything that you believe in, day in and day out, right? And it becomes your true north, because you're going to sway. You're going to go off course. There's going to be politics. There's going to be losses. There's going to be player suspensions, whatever it is. But your purpose doesn't change. Now, it can evolve over the years, right? But it is what, you know, what Joe says, which I agree with, is coaches burn out when they lose sight of their purpose, when coaching becomes something other than their why. And I would agree with that, because I've been through that as well. So for me, and I talk about in the book, you know, this can always evolve, and mine has certainly evolved over the years. But, you know, what I put at the time of writing the book was, you know, I coached to build a lifelong love of activity in children and the, you know, kids that I mentor, and to use the power of sports to intentionally develop character and transform lives, right? This is what I believe in. I work now with middle school kids. That's who I love to coach. That's where I spend my coaching time these days. And so I want them to love sport and love activity and be active for life. And then I want to use sport to teach them character traits that transcend the soccer field, lacrosse field, whatever they play, because sports skills become life skills. That's what I use it for. And if I do my job, I'm not going to prevent a future, you know, Olympian from becoming an Olympian. I'm only going to promote that along the way. And maybe I'm going to give them a more solid foundation, because there's a lot of, quote, talented athletes whose ability takes them to a place that their character, you know, can no longer withstand, right? And so I feel like the kids that I work with, I am shaping their behaviors and instilling the type of things that play well in the long term, not just the cards, but also, you know, things like a teachable spirit, right? Things like grit, things like, you know, commitment, like these things matter, right? Things like respect. And if I can use the soccer that I coach to teach that, then, you know, that's why I'm here. And so when I get an angry parent or I get a bad call and we lose a game, if I can just reconnect with that, like, well, you know what? Like, what did we learn from this? This was a good thing today. And if I can model learning, my kids can too.
So you talked about right there as part of your purpose is using it to develop the character of your players. And I know in the book, you talked about two different types of character development. You talked about performance character and moral character. Talk a little bit about the difference between the two, and maybe just give us a couple of examples of each one and how you as a coach can help to develop those in your players.
Well, I think that those two things come down to this question, which I think is a really interesting one, and one that's been sort of mulling around in my head recently, now that I'll probably get back to writing blog posts after writing a book, you know, which is this idea of, is sport fundamentally good? And 15 years ago, 10 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, really quickly, I'd be like, yeah, of course it is. But now I don't think so. I think sport is fundamentally neutral, just like a car is, right? You know, a car is neither good nor bad. In the hands of a drunk driver, a car is awful. In the hands of an ambulance driver racing you to the hospital, a car is the greatest good, right? And I think sport is the same way. if but the problem is, if we assume it's fundamentally good, then we send our kids there and we just assume that good things will happen. But we know that that doesn't happen. Sport is only good when coaches are intentionally good and they do the right things and they're well trained and they have this higher purpose than winning and they're in it to develop the person and not just the athlete. That's when sport becomes good. And so right alongside that is, you know, people say, oh, sport develops character. And again, that's not true either, or it's true in that sport might develop performance character, right? You're doing wind sprints, you're working, have a super hard practice. Yeah, you might develop resilience, great character trait. You might develop, you know, effort and hard work. But sport does not develop moral character, which is integrity, respect, all these sort of things, compassion, unless it's intentionally taught and weaved into the coaching. And so our job as coaches is to develop both. And those other things, they can happen accidentally once in a while. But if we really believe that sport is about developing character, then we have to teach those things, because there are going to be moments when, you know, integrity is questioned, right? My middle schoolers came home today and talked about in PE how they had to do extra push-ups at the end because they were doing some parkour type course running and a bunch of kids cut the course, right? And so we had a great conversation about, well, what does that mean for you, right? What if they got away with it? What would you do? Does that mean that you should cut the course next time you go? And, you know, great opportunity to talk to, you know, my kids about stories from my athletic career and when people cut the runs or cut the corners or stop short of the line. And so as coaches, like, if we want to teach those things that we call moral character, which I think we all agree are really important, then we have to intentionally talk about them and weave in lessons about them and make them things that we highlight and shine the light on amongst our players, or it's not going to happen.
Why do you think it, in your opinion, why do you think that that doesn't happen maybe as much as you or I would expect it to happen? What is the resistance, or what are the stumbling blocks for coaches of incorporating those things into their coaching?
Well, they say they don't have time, right? I don't have time to talk about this, which, you know, I always say it's not the quantity of practice you have, it's the quality of practice, right? And so I think focusing on character traits gives you higher quality practices. And then also, you know, our focus on outcomes. I mean, if I'm only worried about winning, then why would I care about moral character, right? You know what? If you can cheat on that play and that gets us the bucket, that gets us the ball back, then go ahead and cheat, right? And we see this all the time in sports. I mean, one of the really interesting sports that I don't do a ton of work in is tennis. And any parent who has a kid in high-level tennis, you know, they know, you know, you go to these big tennis tournaments and the kids referee themselves. And they know the exact kids on the exact point that kid's going to cheat.
Yep. No right? doubt. I coached tennis for a couple of years.
Well, there you go.
I know that well.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, tennis has an integrity problem. And there's too many coaches out there, right? If your kid that you're coaching is constantly cheating and you're not doing anything about it, I mean, what are you doing? Why are you even here? In my opinion,
I agree. I think, to me, it comes down to, you know, we talked about it right off the top when we talked about the, you know, the five characteristics that kids want in a coach, and you read that list and then you just read the opposite characteristics. And, you know, if you had a discussion, one-on-one conversation with a coach who was condoning that cheating, or with a parent who, you know, is doing things in a way that, I think if you really talk to them one-on-one and say, hey, look at what you're doing. Is this really what you want? I think the coach would probably say, yeah, you're right. It's probably not what I want. Or the parent would probably say, yeah, it's not what I want. But yet they allow themselves to be caught up in whether it's outcomes, or they allow themselves to be caught up in the emotion of the moment, or the comparisons between their team or their kid and other teams and kids. And we get into that whole psychological aspect of it. And to me, it still comes down to that word that we keep throwing back and forth, which is being intentional. And I think if you're intentional about what it is that you're trying to accomplish, if you're intentional about your values, if you're intentional in teaching those both moral character and performance character, and you're looking for opportunities to pull out teachable moments in your practice, and you're taking 10 minutes at the beginning of your practice to go through an activity that's going to help kids to think about how do I become more trustworthy? How do I go about being someone that people can depend on? If you do that intentionally, you're much more likely to get the results that you want. I think sometimes, as I've said, that we just get caught up in things are moving. We don't have enough time. I'm busy. I just to plan that extra. I have enough on my plate just to try to plan the activities for practice, let alone worry about this other stuff and weaving all that in. And then I just kind of lose sight of the why I'm out here doing it. And I know I've said this on the podcast before, and I think it plays very well with what we're talking about here. And that is, if you have a conversation with a parent and you're a coach and you're explaining to them why you want to do some character and leadership pieces as part of what you're trying to teach your kids, like I'll have practice with, and I've did this with my two older kids, and I'm doing it with my daughter now, where we create these notebooks and we'll sit down for the first, 10, 15, 20 minutes of practice where we have court time. And we'll sit down on the court, we'll have our notebooks open, and we'll be talking about, we'll have an activity planned that, is designed to help them become a better teammate, or is based on, again, a character trait or something that you're trying to get them to think about and develop. And a lot of people look at, well, hey, you're sitting on the court, that's time. Why aren't we practicing basketball? Why are we taking the time to do this? And I think you really have to educate your parents, your players, and be upfront with them and say, look, what I'm trying to do here is more than just about the game today. It's the long view of, look, if we can develop our kids into better people, in addition to teaching them the sport and making them better athletes, but if we can also help them to become better people in the long run, no matter where they end up, and let's say they're part of that 0.001% of athletes who ends up having a professional career, couldn't this stuff that we're working on here in terms of character and leadership, won't that still benefit them as a professional athlete? And then take it one step further, when they retire as a professional athlete, even if they've made some money playing a sport, which is highly unlikely as we all know, but let's say they do and now they retire, even athletes who have very long careers end up finishing and they have more than half their life still to live. And if we want them to develop and be healthy and happy human beings and be contributors to society in a positive, meaningful way, we can use sport, as you've talked about, to be able to do that. And I think we have to continue to educate coaches, parents, players on the value of that beyond just, again, that short term of, hey, we got to work on more left-handed layups tonight in practice. Well, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think, the thing is, Mike, it's like we also, right, and I'm not necessarily advocating for, expensive court time or ice time sitting there. Like, hey, show up 20 minutes early.
Right.
And we're doing it then, and then we're going to hit the court. But let me just tell coaches how easy this is, right? You set out your practice. This is what we're going to do today. This is what we're looking for. And guys, one of the things that's going to make you perform your best today is integrity. What does integrity mean to you? And then the kids can explore, right? And that means if we do sprints, you run all the way to the line. It means you play out every play, so you dive for that loose ball, so that you hustle in transition. Great. Now, during practice, right, go out there. We're going to do these things, but I'm also going to look for integrity. I want to see players who are living and breathing integrity. And then during practice, instead of just calling out a great pass or a great shot, you say, Jimmy, I saw you dive for that ball. You played that play to the end. That's integrity. That's going to make us play our very best. Keep that up, right? That's it. How much time did that take me? 3 minutes? Find me a coach. Find me a coach that says, I don't have 3 minutes spare at practice, and I'll come, I'll observe your practice, and I guarantee I'll find you 3 minutes.
Absolutely. And I think what you're also saying is that you just look for opportunities to build it in naturally. And when you first do that, I think people probably find that maybe difficult to start looking for different things. But I think just like anything else, as you do it more and more, it becomes sort of second nature. Like I would guess that when you're coaching at this point, that you're saying those things and finding those things and pointing those things out without necessarily being consciously aware of pulling them out all the time. Like you don't have to sit and go, okay, I'm going to look for integrity today. You're always constantly on the lookout for those things because you have experience doing it. I think sometimes coaches are scared. Ooh, that's something new. I'm not sure I can do that. But as you do it,
and don't
just
have
like,
10,
just like
have
we
2,
asked,
have 3, right? There, you don't have to have a ton of them.
For sure.
And you can focus on one for a month and you pick one per month. But you know, really what you look at your kids and you say, you know, how do we look when we're playing our best? What are we doing? And those become our non-negotiables, right? And so eventually you don't have to talk about them because they show themselves every day because this is just how we do things here. And that's culture. And culture is not, you know, it's not an event. It's not a pasta feed. It's not one meeting. It's a process. It's something that you do day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. And great cultures are different, right? I think Bill Walsh, the football coach, says champions act like champions before they become champions, right? That's culture.
So true. To go along with that, one of the things that you talked about, I'm pretty sure that James Leith actually shared this with you, was the idea of the legacy book. To me, that fits in perfectly with what we're talking about here is once you've sort of established that culture, now you can create this legacy book that lets everybody know what it is that you stand for, what your culture is all about. And it comes not from you as the coach or the head of an organization. It comes from the people who have lived and breathed and been a part of that culture. So talk a little bit about the legacy book and how a coach might incorporate that into their, whether it's their high school or college program or a youth program, for that matter.
To youth program as well. So kudos to James Leith for those. I don't know if he's been on your podcast or not, but
we're working on James. We're trying to coordinate with him. So hopefully it's going to happen soon.
Awesome. Well, he's doing some amazing work now with the Chicago Bulls, so he could probably tell you some good stuff there too. But James used to be the head of leadership at IMG Academy in Bradenton, and you know what he wanted to do there was, you know, he got this idea from the New Zealand All Blacks in rugby that, you know, you're just the person in the shirt and your job is to leave the shirt in a better place. And so if we run a high school program, we run a college team, you know, one of the things that we always want to do is connect our alumni to the program and have our current players understand what it means to be part of this program. So what James did at IMG was he started these legacy book things, and I think they're a great idea. And I've started them with a couple of college teams that I work with, where take basketball is probably a perfect example. You could, you know, to start, you know, you reach out to your alums and you ask them, you know, to write a letter about what it meant to be part of this program. And then you create a book. You can create a book for everyone who wears number 5, or, you know, maybe numbers in basketball is not the best way to do it because, but maybe it's by position. And then you collect all these letters in a notebook. And now when the new kid comes along and, okay, here's your new point guard, he gets the point guard book. And the point guard book has, you know, 10, 15 years of letters from people who have played point guard for, you know, XYZ high school. And what it meant to them to be part of that program and how it's affected their life after, right? Now you're not just giving someone a uniform, you're giving them a responsibility and you're connecting them to the people who have come before them. And if you do that enough, all of a sudden, you know, getting a jersey means a little bit more than just, oh, look, a nice Nike uniform, right? It's like, I'm wearing number 5. And look at who's come before me as number 5. I got some pretty big shoes to fill here. And so I think it's just such a powerful thing to connect the past, the present, and the future of the program. I really don't see any negatives to doing it, to be honest with you. So kudos to James, Unleash the Athlete. He's got a lot of great stuff, but that's one of the best ideas he's ever given me.
Yeah, it's powerful. I can only imagine what that would be like to walk in, you know, on the first day as a member of a high school basketball program or a college program and be handed that legacy book and just to go through and read it and figure out, wow, like this is what was going on here before me. I have a lot that I have to live up to. I have a lot that I have to, the expectation that is being placed on me is powerful. And I think when you hear it firsthand from people who are in the same shoes that those players are going to be in, the current players are going to be in, to me, that there would be nothing more powerful. Like, I'd love to just sit and watch a kid read that thing and see what, you know, just read their facial expressions and then just get them to share with what, you know, what they felt after they read it. I can only imagine how powerful that would be.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, for sure. You know, if you feel nothing, then you're probably not a good fit anyway.
I agree. And,
you know, but I mean, I couldn't imagine the vast majority of people, at least in that moment, not feeling something and some connection to something bigger than them. And, you know, having that higher purpose than winning is one of the big drivers of success. I mean, I wrote a whole chapter about that. So, I think having a legacy book is a really cool thing, especially if you have been at a program for a while and you are, you know, in touch. I mean, I have a friend that I just sent a copy of the book to, who has been a very successful high school basketball coach. He's a USA basketball coach. And, you know, at his high school, his dad was the coach for 30 years and he's been there for 20. So there's 50 years of his family has been the varsity basketball coach at this school. I'm like, dude, start reaching out to some alums.
Exactly. You could have a 50 year. That's a big, thick book right there.
That's a big, thick book.
But it would be great to read for sure. And I think, you know, not only would it be valuable for the players, but I can only imagine how powerful it would be for the coach to sit down and read that and get a feel for, especially if you had been the person who had been, as you said, had been a long time coach in the same program. And to be able to hear the perspective of players who had played for you and what it meant to be a part of your program, I could think that would be affirming that the things that you were doing were having, you know, this kind of impact. And I think it would be something that any coach would be proud to have those books on their shelf and to be able to share them with kids who are a part of their program. I just can't imagine, again, sitting and looking at somebody reading that as a coach and just the amount of pride that you would feel for having created, you know, that type of culture within your program. Going along with that, as long as we're in the culture part here, you talked about within your program to look for cultural architects and then also conversely look for cultural assassins. And talk a little bit about what each one of those terms means and then how you want to cultivate the one and try to cut out the other.
Yeah. And so this was a term coined by, I think he's Norwegian psychologist, Willy Rilo. And he talks about that. Like, you know, when you're trying to establish a culture, you're looking for your couple of players who are your cultural architects, your top 10 percenters, the people who exhibit the behaviors day after day without being asked, that you know will drive the success of your program. And at the same time, you're on the lookout for cultural assassins who are highly influential individuals, maybe because they're incredibly talented or incredibly charismatic, who do the opposite, who break down the culture. And so, you know, in the book, I share a story from a friend of mine, Damian Hughes, who talks about, you know, I have to tell a soccer story, but there's a very famous soccer coach named Pep Guardiola, and Pep Guardiola had never coached a high-level team before you know, a first team when he became the coach of Barcelona. And at his first press conference, he named the three best players, African Player of the Year, World Player of the Year, World Cup star, three guys. And he said, they're no longer in our plans because they don't buy into what we're doing here. And the press was shocked. And they're like, how can you get rid of these three guys? They're legends. They're stars. But what Pep Guardiola realized was this one Brazilian guy, Ronaldinho, who used to be a cultural architect. He used to drive it. He was the man. He had won a World Cup. He was the World Player of the Year. And he just he flipped the switch. He turned off. And he'd show up late to practice. He'd sleep on the training table. He'd fake injuries because he was out partying all night. And in his last year, 10 players on the first team got divorced. And so Pep Guardiola comes in and goes, that guy can't be here because he is so influential and he's dragging the team in the wrong direction. And so he promoted some youth players from their academy, you know, guys like Lionel Messi, who were pretty good, right? And right. All of a sudden, you know, changed the whole thing around. And so, you know, I think of Steve Kerr, you know, when he got to the Warriors, he recognized, you know, Steph Curry was a cultural architect. And guess what Steph's all about? He's about joy and he's about compassion. So Steve knows right there, my best player also is going to live and breathe what matters the most to me. I'm going to keep highlighting that, you know, and other players as well. I mean, Andre Iguodala, NBA All-Star, Olympian, first meeting, Steve says, I think you should come off the bench. And Iggy was like, okay, I'll do it, right? And then, you know, goes on that first year, the sixth man, wins sixth man of the year. And then in the NBA Finals, they decide to go to a small lineup. He starts, wins the Finals MVP. They win the championship, right? And because he was selfless, because he was, you know, compassionate and for the family, that Steve said, look, if an NBA All-Star says, I'll come off the bench, I think you should do what the team needs you to do as well. And so that set the tone, right? And, these are the type of things that as a coach, when our best player exemplifies everything that matters most, man, highlight that. And when our best player is the opposite, we're in trouble. Like, we have to intentionally change that behavior or that behavior is going to drag the whole team down. But hopefully you're not waiting till your senior year, the kid's senior year, to start changing that behavior.
Right, right. I think that comes down to something that we've talked to a lot of coaches about, and that is the ability of a coach to tell a player the truth. And I think sometimes coaches find that to be challenging because in a lot of cases, they may be worried that, look, if I tell this player the truth about whether it's their attitude or something about their play in today's world where people are always chasing and thinking that the grass is greener on the other side, there's often times where coaches are afraid to tell players the truth about just some of the things that you talked about. Like, we can't have you doing X, Y, and Z because it's not part of our culture. And I think that sometimes from a coaching perspective, that has to be a learned behavior in terms of being able to be brutally honest with people about what it is that you expect from them. And I think that it comes down to, as a coach, you have to, again, live your values, you have to live your culture, and then be able to go home and put your head down on the pillow at night and go to sleep. And telling the truth to players and to parents, their families, is, I think, important. And I think it's sometimes difficult in today's environment, both at the high school and college level. And I think even trickles down to the youth level when we talk about the amount of money that's out there in youth sports, youth basketball. If I tell this kid, hey, you've got to work on X, Y, and Z, or I need you to, you know, be this type of person, that family may just pick up and take their money and their program, you know, take their kid somewhere else. And so I think that's a challenge that coaches face. But ultimately, if we think about what we talked about earlier, which is, what are my values? What's my coaching purpose statement? That's going to help guide me in the fact of, how am I going to be able to have the impact that I want to have on the kids that are in front of me? And how am I going to be able to build the type of culture that I want to build? And I think that story you shared with Ronaldinho is perfect in that that coach could have come in and just said, look, this guy's he's great. I'm just going to put up with this because he's such a good player. Well, guess what? Him being a good player infects everybody else because he's not living up to the standards that you want to put in place as a coach.
Yeah, and that which you don't condemn, you condone, right? And I think every coach, especially of those of us, right, that's professional sport. That's sport for entertainment. We're in sport for development, right? And so, you know, every coach has to ask themselves, what am I willing to compromise to win, right? So what if that kid's going to transfer and leave, right? If they are the antithesis of everything your program is about, like sometimes, you know, you have to say, okay, then go. And a lot of times when kids like that go, guess what? The team doesn't get worse. It gets better.
Absolutely.
and regardless of whether you're better or worse, it's usually a more fun group to coach because people are bought in and then they say, ah, okay, this is real. This is the standard. And the thing about building great cultures too is sometimes they can absorb someone who doesn't always toe the line. And I think the perfect example of that in basketball is the Bulls with Dennis Rodman, right? And Phil Jackson approached Pippen and Jordan and, you know, Bill Cartwright and them and said, we have a chance to get Dennis Rodman. He is not going to toe the line here, right? He's going to do some weird stuff. He's going to cross the line. He is his own person.
Wait, but Dennis Rodman, you know, was weird?
Hold on a second. It's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
But you know what? He's going to help. We'll win a championship if we get Dennis because he's going to play defense and he's going to rebound and he's going to do all the things that let you guys be the best. So are we willing to bring him on? Right. And so, you know, Jordan and Pippen said, yeah, let's do it. Right. He's going to help us win. We can absorb one Dennis Rodman, not three, one. Right. And, you know, and so I think Phil Jackson tells the story in 11 Rings or, you know, one of his books. First day, you know, Rodman shows up to practice. Cardinal rule number one, have your shoes tied. And he's standing there on the court and his shoes are untied and he's just standing there and Phil looks at it and just keeps talking and just keeps going and skips over it. And everyone sees that. But since he had prepared his team for this, it just goes. And you know what? So Rodman didn't get a rise out of him, didn't get admonished. He showed up from now on with his shoes untied. Right, or with his shoes tied because, right. Oh, well, whatever, you know, they're going to let me be me. But as long as me doesn't disrupt us, that's going to be okay.
Yeah. And obviously that was a very unique situation with the type of leaders that they had on that team and the fact that they talked about it and discussed it beforehand. And, you know, as coaches, you want to make sure that what you're doing fits with the players that you have and that they fit into the program that you're trying to put together. And you make a great point of oftentimes when you get rid of or when a player ends up leaving your program because they don't fit the culture or because they don't agree with what you're doing in terms of your program, you often end up happier. And not only do you end up happier, but the rest of the players on the team end up happier. And that one player who just won't conform to the culture can be such a black cloud over a team. And I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen personally firsthand to teams that I've been associated with as a coach. And ultimately, you'd be much better off without that player, regardless of how talented he or she may be.
Exactly. And again, when we are coaching children, coaching middle schoolers, coaching high schoolers, our first job is, can we shape that behavior?
Correct, absolutely.
Can we say to that kid, like, is that who you want to be? 99% of kids are going to be like, no, right? And then you're like, okay, how can I help you change? And so shaping behavior is one of the most important things that we do in the sport for development world, right? You got a kid whose attitude you don't like, don't just cut them. I mean, you might be the last coach, the last person in that kid's life who has a chance to set him on the straight and narrow, right? If you cut him loose, he might be in jail next week. So, you know, the idea is, right, what, you know, it's not always just to say bye-bye, but, you know, can I help make change? And if, you know, I can't, if we've given a few chances and this person's just not buying in, well, yeah, you know what? We're going to move on from you now. because you're just not bought in. And I really think, and this is, if anyone's an athletic director here or a principal or whatever, like, this is what's so important. Like, we have to sit down with our coaches before the season and understand what does quality coaching look like, right? How am I going to be evaluated on the job that I do? And if you tell me it's about character development and stuff like that, then as an AD and as a principal, you got to have the coaches back. You cannot cave at the first angry parent and fire a coach or a couple of angry parents. You have to keep your finger, you know, on the pulse and understand what's happening there. But if you've set these benchmarks for your coach in terms of this is how we expect you to treat players, this is how we expect you to, you know, run practices, these are the school rules, these are the disciplinary rules, you know, and do this. And yeah, we want you to know what you're talking about and win some games, but you know, that can't be the only thing they're evaluated on. And we're living in this world right now where far too many great coaches are getting fired because, you know what, they found that kid who didn't want to change and they did not compromise for that kid. And oh boy, that kid's dad is on the school board. Next thing you know, people are losing their jobs. And that's what's really, really sad. And I've had, you know, friends in the Division I college coaching world lose their jobs after decades at schools, and, you know, club coaches and high school coaches. And to me, that's really sad because, A, you just totally screwed that kid over for the rest of his or her life. You just told him, hey, you know what? I don't have to toe the line ever. Daddy's going to fix it. Right. And, you know, if that coach is being tough, but doing it in a demanding way and a very respectful way, then you got to back that coach.
Yeah. I think there is a disconnect there that we oftentimes say one thing and then in practice with how we evaluate coaches ends up being different. So we might say we want to focus on academics. We might say we want to focus on developing good citizens. We might say that we want to focus on the process, but then, you know, at the end of the season when I'm 6-15, you know, I lose my job because I didn't win enough. And I think that's, unfortunately, it happens, as you said, far more often than any of us would like to believe. And I think it's one of the things that makes coaching today such a challenge. And yet at the same time, we all know that what we just described, where you take a kid who maybe initially doesn't buy in and you do shape their behavior, you do get them eventually to come around, and you've made that kind of impact that changes a kid's life. And especially in today's society where oftentimes kids' home lives aren't ideal, and maybe that team and that coach provides some structure to their life that they're not getting anywhere else. And that's an incredibly powerful thing that you have in your hands as a coach. And I just think that you would hope that everybody could get eventually onto the same page, and we could get through and try to do all the things that we talk about in your book and get coaches to buy into it, get ADs to buy into it. And then we would ultimately create an environment of sport where the experience for every single stakeholder is a positive one. And it's a challenge. It's a challenge. But I think that people like you and there's a lot of people out there that are, you know, espousing the same kinds of values and things that we're talking about here tonight, that, you know, we're going to continue to work at it. You know, again, one person, one coach, one AD, one player at a time. And that's how the movement grows. And I think that's where we're headed.
Mm-hmm. I agree, man. Well said.
All right. I want to talk two other things from the book. We're at about an hour and 15 minutes. So I want to go about 15 more minutes with you, John, and just talk about two other things. One is, because I think these are things that are very relevant for coaches out there who are coaching at the youth sports level. One is, let's talk about the difference between coaching boys and girls. Let's start there. And then the second thing I want to talk about is coaching your own kid, and just get some advice for people out there who may be in that situation. Because a lot of times, especially at the youth level, we know that the reason why we get into youth coaching is because we're coaching our own children. So let's start with the difference between coaching boys and girls. talk about that for a few minutes, and then we'll jump into coaching your own kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, part of the reason I wrote this book, you know, the non-used subtitle is kind of everything you should have learned in coaching school, but you didn't. Right. And so the two things that you just mentioned there, I think are two of the biggest ones. 80% of coaches at some time or other coach their own kid. Right. So, you know, is there things we should be aware of? And then the other is, you know, a lot of people, right? You, like you said, you have sons, daughters, you know, is there a difference between coaching boys and girls? And so I was very careful in this chapter to sort of give the big caveats that A, this is a generalization and all generalizations end at the individual level. B, it's just a difference. It doesn't mean one's better or worse, one's right or one's wrong. And there's lots of differences we could talk about. We could talk about the difference between coaching suburban kids and inner city kids. We could be the difference between coaching 10-year-olds and coaching 18-year-olds. The difference between coaching kids who grew up in the U.S. and kids who grew up in Australia, right? There's lots of differences. This is just one. And so I think, you know, there's a couple of characteristics, and I've done both, right? I've coached, you know, 5-year-old girls and boys. I've coached Division I college men and women and every age in between. So I have a lot of practical experience. And then I reached out to some people who have coached, you know, those at a very high level, some researchers to put together, you know, this chapter. And yeah, you know, there are gender differences, right? Cultural differences in the way boys and girls are raised that rear their heads in the sporting world in terms of, you know, I mean, I think one of the big ones is as long as you're talking about performance stuff, by all means, praise boys in public, right? If I say, Mike, best player on the court today, you are the man. All your teammates are like, Mike, you're the man. Awesome. Mike, you feel great about yourself. If I say to a high school girl, Mary, you're the best player on the court today, Mary's mortified. Her teammates are angry at her because why didn't they get singled out? She's upset at you because you singled her out, right? And you've just lost the locker room, right? So sometimes, you know, the sort of general rule is in general, you know, you can praise and criticize boys in public and you should praise and critique girls in private. And if in doubt, regardless of gender, take them both in private. So that's one of the big differences.
Yeah, that's really good. The other one that stuck out for me, and I just want to hear your take on that one, is that men are hard to coach, or boys are hard to coach, but easy to manage. Girls are easy to coach, but hard to manage. And that, when I read that, I'd never heard it expressed quite so clearly and eloquently, but I thought it was a perfect encapsulation of, I think, the experiences that I've had, and I understand where that came from. So just talk a little bit about what that means for somebody who's coaching either gender.
Yeah. So, you know, from a very young age, you know, boys, right, boys tend to congregate in groups and we get in an argument, we have a fight, we argue, maybe we punch someone in the face, and then we move on and we're over it. From a very young age, girls are culturalized in general to get along and seek equilibrium. And so, you know, I think in team environments, what you start to see around the middle school age, and again, I just went through this. I spent 3 years coaching, you know, 11 to 13-year-old girls, and now I'm on my 3-year stint of 11 to 13-year-old boys. And the biggest difference on day one that I notice right out the gates is the boys, anything that crosses their mind, however negative or virulent, it comes right out their mouth, right? You know, come on, you suck. Why'd you turn there? Give me the ball. Why don't you pass? Whatever. You know, a girl would never say that. They say, good try. And then they walk off and say, God, Katie is so selfish. Why doesn't she ever pass the ball? Right? And so the boys get it out. But then as soon as practice is over, you know, you just fouled me. You kicked me. You fouled me 7 times. We go to the water cooler. Practice is over. We're good. Right? We leave it on the court. And girls in general tend to drag these disagreements and then they fester over time. And so what happens in all the different girls, and you know, I usually have a 3-year cycle with teams. That's what I feel like I work well with. And after 3 years with a boys team, I'm usually kind of tired of them saying, well, coach, why are we doing this? Right? So they're hard to coach. But I have no personnel management issues. If a new player comes into the team, they're like, hey, what's your name? Can you play? Sweet. Here we go.
Right.
Right? And with the girls in general, again, where, you know, this is what we're going to do in practice. Great, coach. Let's go. But the management of personalities and getting them all to get along, that's exhausting. And I'm just exhausted after 3 years. You know, when you bring in a new player and, you know, the girls are like, well, why is she here? Whose spot is she going to take? How is she going to disrupt the chemistry? Right. And so it's just a really different dynamic. And I'm not saying one's better or one's worse. The whole point of the chapter is if you are not aware that these things can and will exist from time to time, and you're not intentional about coaching in these situations, you're going to leave something on the table.
Yeah, I think those are two great pieces of advice for people who maybe are transitioning. Or again, I think it's especially valuable for someone who is coaching the opposite gender of themselves. So if I'm a dad and I'm coaching my daughter's team, those are great things to be aware of. And conversely, if I'm a mom and I'm coaching my son's team, great things to be aware of, because we tend to obviously come at things from our own gender point of view. And just by being aware of it and thinking it through, I think you can ultimately end up making better decisions and being a better coach for whatever group it is that you're in front of, just by being aware of some of those things that you just shared, and then a couple other points that you make in the book. All right, let's talk about coaching your own child. Give us some thoughts, some ideas that can help me if I'm going to coach my own kid to make the experience positive for me, for my own child, and for the other kids that are on the team.
Mm-hmm. Great, great question. So, you know, I think the biggest takeaway I can give for that is that when you're coaching your own kid, you're wearing two hats. You're wearing your coaching hat and your father hat, or your parent hat, right? Your mother hat, your parent hat. And you have to know when to put one on and when to put the other one on. For too many kids in sport, practice never ends when mom or dad is the coach, usually dad, right? Practice never ends. And it's so, so important to be able to just take that off. Now, I've talked to some people who metaphorically have two hats. They keep a coaching hat in their car. And when they have that hat on, right, son, you will refer to me as coach, not dad. And, you know, that's our relationship in this moment. You're not, you know, you're the most important person in my life when I have my dad hat on. But right now you're one of 16. And then they'll get in their car, kid will sit in the car, and they'll switch hats. Now I'm dad again, and I got to stop coaching, right? And so I think, and I've coached my own kids, you know, all through the years, and I screw this up all the time.
It's hard. It's very hard.
I'm not, but I always catch myself saying, you know what? There's no other kid right now who's having this conversation, right? And I just got to create the space, and I guess got to let it go. And, you know, now if your kid brings it up, by all means, have that conversation. And sometimes there's going to be conversations where it's, you know, where they'll ask you something and maybe it's appropriate to say, would you like me to answer that as your coach or as your dad? Because that might be two different things.
For sure.
And the last thing I'll just leave people with is, you know what, if you have an assistant coach and you're butting heads with your own kid in practice, turn the coaching of your kid over to your assistant, and maybe you coach her kid or you coach his kid, and just step away from coaching your kid for a bit and let someone else do it. Because sometimes you'd be amazed how your kid will never listen to you is like, you know, front and center, eyes, ears open, standing at attention, taking in everything when the words come from somebody else.
I used to have people tell me that, John, before I had my own kids. And they would come to me and they would say, I want you to work with little Johnny here because, you know, he won't listen to me. You know, I know a lot about the game and I coach, but he just won't listen to me. I used to look at those people like they were crazy. I'm like, what do you mean? Like your own kid? I'm like, you're a successful high school varsity coach, or you've had this playing experience. I don't understand why they won't listen to you. And I used to really honestly look at those people and say, I can't even relate to you. And then as soon as I have my own kids, you see, like, they hear you on so many things that sports is supposed to be a place where they can have fun. And there's definitely times, like, I've spent a lot of time coaching my own kids. But I also learned very quickly that there's places where I don't need to coach them. So I don't have any soccer background. So all my kids played at least a little bit of soccer. I never coached them 1 second of soccer. I coached, I think, one season of baseball with my son, and then I got out of it and handed him over to somebody else. And I still coach them in basketball, but I don't coach their school seasons, and they hear other voices besides just mine. Mm-hmm. And I think it does make a huge difference. And yet, I think you said it, you know, very well, that when you're coaching your own kid, that, you know, you've made mistakes in this area. And mm-hmm. you're a person who obviously has a tremendous amount of knowledge about what the right thing to do is. And I feel like I'm in that same position, that over the years I've read and learned and tried to figure out what is the best way to go about having these coach player, parent player relationships. And it's still very, very difficult. And I still make mistakes, and I know what the pitfalls are. I know what the potential bad outcomes are if I don't navigate this correctly. So I can only imagine how difficult it is for the average parent who, you know, hasn't done the reading and just isn't as educated as maybe somebody like you or I about these particular issues. And I just think it's a really, really fine line to walk when you're coaching your own kid, and it's challenging. And again, it's super rewarding. There's nothing better than the opportunity to coach your own kid if you do it correctly.
Yeah, exactly. And then again, like you said, you know, turn them over to somebody else and recognize, right, especially if you do know a lot about coaching, when am I going to say something, right? When will I intervene? You know, I had a great talk with Jenny Levy, who's the coach of UNC women's lacrosse, multiple time national champion, national team coach. And she's like, you know, my husband and I, both college All-Americans in lacrosse, when our kids play sports, we never say anything, even, you know, when it has to do with the X's and O's, right? We'll never say anything to the coach because we appreciate the fact they're out there. And so we know a lot about the sport, and we recognize that some of these coaches are not going to run great practices. They're not going to do this. But you know what? We won't say anything because thanks for coaching. But we will step up when it's a human issue, right? If you're not treating the kids right, my kids practice, you know, coming home crying from practice or something like that. If you're demeaning children, yeah, I'm going to speak up, right? A, as in, you know, a coach who has a lot of experience, but B, as, you know, the parent of this child. And so sometimes it's hard to not coach and look at coaching and go, oh, man, this is not so good.
Right.
But, you know, sometimes you have to bite your tongue. And I've been in that situation where my kids have had phenomenal outside coaches. I've been in the situation where my kids have had, you know, not so phenomenal outside coaches, but you know what? They're nice people. And then, you know, I was in one situation where, you know, I was like, you know what? I mean, this was like a paid travel sporting experience. I'm like, I'm not going to pay for this. There's no way I'm going to pay for this. This is ridiculous. And so, you know, I've been in all those situations, and it's really hard. You know, it's really hard sometimes to sit there and to say, is this the appropriate moment for me to say something?
Yeah, that's a fine line to walk for sure. And I think that mm-hmm. what you just described of it being a technical coaching issue or a human coaching issue, I think that that's a good place to be able to draw that line where, yeah, you know, you may not agree with every single thing that happens in a practice setting from an X's and O, a technical, a practice design standpoint, fine. But, you know, if a kid is being mistreated or something along those lines, then I think that's the point where you have to step in. And then as a coach, I think one of the other things that's always a challenge is when you're sitting in the stands, you know, I try to do a really good job of keeping quiet and just watching. And I think mm-hmm. that all my kids, I don't know if they've said it directly to me, but I know just from their demeanor and the way that they react to what other parents are yelling and saying to their kids, that they appreciate the fact that I just sit there. And I had a funny thing happen to me yesterday at my son's basketball game. I had, you know, there's obviously a bunch of different parents that come and watch the games, and, you know, there's, I'll sit with different people depending on, you know, you kind of, you know, you're at a middle school gym, so the bleachers oftentimes are small. So you kind of come in, you find your seat, and, you know, you end up sitting next to different parents and people that you've known for a while. And I had one of the parents that came and sat next to me yesterday, and he said, "Oh, I'm sitting next to you. I'm going to have to be good today." And so I kind of got a chuckle out of that. I'm like, well, at least maybe I'm serving as a role model for other parents, maybe somewhere out there. So I'm bringing some bit of good here to the situation. So I thought that was kind of funny yesterday.
My response to that is always like, why would you think it would be okay to not be good on all the other days?
That's right. There you go. Right. So
why
true.
Is that okay?
Yeah. So true. All right, John, we're up at an hour and a half. So I want to, before we go, I want to give you an opportunity to let people know how they can get the book. And then if there's anything that we didn't talk about tonight that you want to share, a story, some other piece from the book that you think is important to share, please do that, and then we'll wrap up the episode.
You know, thanks, man. I appreciate that. I mean, we covered a ton of ground here. So, you know, the book's Every Moment Matters, How the World's Best Coaches Inspire Their Athletes and Build Championship Teams. You know, Amazon is the best place to get it, you know, worldwide and whatever, how many countries, bookstores, you know, Barnes & Noble, and then we'll have it as well. It might not be in right away, but you can certainly request it or at your library and stuff. You know, my website is changingthegameproject.com. If you want a signed copy, go there. And then I also do some, you know, bulk discounts. So I've had, since the book launched, you know, a bunch of schools said, you know what, 20 books for our coaching staff. And so if that's something you're interested in, I'm happy to, you know, give you 25% off per book or something and get those books out to you that way as well. So, that you just have to email me, John, John, at changingthegameproject.com. And if you're asking me for a parting thought, we covered so much ground here. What I would say is this: the idea of this book, I think the idea of any bit of coaching education, is not to go and throw out everything that you've done and start from scratch. If you listen to this podcast, if you care about this stuff, what you're probably doing is a lot of good stuff. And so I say, you know, find 10%, right? What's 10% that you can turn up the dial a little bit, that you can make a little bit better, and layer one thing in? Maybe it's communication, maybe it's intentional culture, maybe it's your practice design, and see how that works. And as that works, then layer something else in. The book has so many activities, so many things to do. It's impossible. This has taken me 20 plus years of coaching to do all the things that I put in this book. So don't try to do it next week, right? Try one thing, start small, do it well, add something else, and over time, just evolve your coaching so that it's evidence-based. And if you do that, you're gonna do really well.
That's great stuff. I'll just piggyback on what you said. To everyone who's a part of the Hoopheads podcast audience, I would highly, highly recommend going out and picking up a copy of this book. When I read through it, I took, I think, 4 or 5 pages of notes, and there are things that make you focus on the big picture. There are things that are actionable that you can do right away. And as John said, it's just packed with stuff that's going to help remind you of why you became a coach and the type of impact that you can have on the kids and the athletes that are in front of you. And really, that's what coaching is all about. So please go and visit John on his website for the Changing the Game Project. Buy the book, Every Moment Matters. It's a great read. You won't regret it. It'll be some of the best money you've ever spent. And I just want to thank everybody for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. As you've listened to the Hoopheads podcast, one common topic that continually comes up in our conversations is character. I'm fortunate to be associated with the Positive Coaching Alliance, a national nonprofit movement that provides valuable tools, training, and resources for coaches, athletes, parents, and administrators that is centered around sports and educational psychology and organizational behavior research. PCA combines this research with practical advice from a national advisory board of top pro and college athletes and coaches who utilize PCA principles at the highest levels of competition. Through a partnership with our local Cleveland chapter of the PCA, we are pleased to offer a discount code to allow you, our listeners, to take a PCA online course for just $20. To take advantage of this offer, visit the store on positivecoach.org and enter the discount code HOOPHEADS20. That's HOOPHEADS20 with two capital H's. Coaches, I hope you'll take advantage of this great offer from the Positive Coaching Alliance and help us continue to grow the game.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.